Dr. Michael Higgins, our speaker this evening, is Vice President for Mission and Catholic Identity at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. Prior to that position, he was President and Vice Chancellor of St. Thomas University in Fredericton, New Brunswick, where he was also a Professor of English and Religious Studies. From 1999 to 2006, he was President and Vice Chancellor of St. Jerome University in the University of Waterloo, Ontario, where he taught a broad array of undergraduate courses, ranging from the history of detective fiction to the history of the papacy, as well as graduate courses ranging from Oscar Wilde and the Decadence to the history of the spiritual autobiography. Professor Higgins is a columnist, a radio documentary maker, most notably acclaimed documentaries on Thomas Merton and most recently Henry Nouwen. He's been a television commentator on Vatican affairs and a regular contributor to Commonweal magazine. In addition, he was the chief advisor for the widely acclaimed TV series Sir Peter Ustinov's Inside the Vatican. Michael is the author or co-author of numerous books and articles, including the award-winning Heretic Blood, The Spiritual Geography of Thomas Merton, Power and Peril, The Catholic Church at the Crossroads, and Stalking the Holy, In Pursuit of Saint-Making. He co-edited the recently published collection Vatican II, A Universal Call to Holiness, which is on sale here. And he's also the official biographer of Henry Nouwen. And recently he published this book, Genius Born of Anguish, The Life and Legacy of Henry Nouwen. And again, there are copies of that available. With the recent announcement of the date for the canonization of Pope John the 23rd, and with his feast day in the Roman liturgical calendar this coming Friday, it's very apposite that Michael's presentation this evening is entitled Thomas Merton and Pope John the 23rd. So please join me in welcoming our speaker this evening, Professor Michael Higgins.
Thank you, Paul. And thank you, everyone, for being here tonight. Can you hear me? I hope so. But if you can't, just shout out, and I'd be happy to adjust the volume. But I think I'm okay. Thank you. That's good. A very subtle acknowledgement of my height. We'll talk later, Paul. It's a pleasure to be back in Ballymun. I've been here many times over the years, doing work and research, and knew various of the directors, including Paul's immediate predecessors. But it's also a pleasure to be back and to discover some people that I know in the hall, even if only distant, to Greg, whom I knew very briefly from years at the University of Waterloo. And Paul, of course, I've known for a number of years, or Linda, who sat on the board with me. And it's like coming home in a way, even though my accent is distinctly different than your own. Kentucky warmth and hospitality, I'm sure, will acknowledge me as one of your own. Well, what I want to do tonight is to look at various convergences, points of connection, if you like, between Giuseppe Roncalli and Thomas Merton. What is it that brought these two men together? And what can we learn in the anniversary year of the Council? Well, it's not quite the anniversary of the year of the Council. Of course, the Council opened on October of 1962, but it is the anniversary year of the death of Roncalli. He died in June of 1963. And as Paul has indicated, we already know that he will be canonized, raised to the altars, as the language would have it, in April of the coming year. And so interest in John the 23rd has grown considerably because of the anniversary year. What is the Council? What does it mean? What are its implications for Catholicism? And why is it that quite a number of people actually don't like the Council? That in and of itself is a bit of a mystery, though from an historical perspective, no mystery at all. And certainly from the point of view of ecclesiastical politics, fairly self-evident. But the council, it was a transformative moment in the life of the Roman Catholic Church. And right in the middle of all this is Thomas Merton. Now, he's not a paretus. He's not a theological expert. He's not a council father. He's not present at the council in any way as an auditor or whatever. But his presence is very much there. And there are reasons for that. Merton is one of the religious thinkers in the Catholic community that helped to pave the way for the flourishing of the council. Now, I'm not suggesting any direct correlation, but undoubtedly many of the council fathers would have read Merton. And the concern, particularly with Rassoursement, the going back or reclaiming of the sources, would have been something that Merton had been engaged in as a Cistercian for a very long time, in fact, predating the council itself. So I'm going to look at the relationship between John the 23rd and Thomas Merton and hope that it's helpful to you in this anniversary year. This is the year of John, as I said. And recently I was struck by a couple of things. What's it called? Need to know, all you need to know media. What do they call? Now you know media. At one point with my colleague Tony Sierra, who's worked with him, I call it up yours media. But then when they contracted me to work, I said, oh, well, I've got to get this title right now. But one of the things that this company does, and this is not a marketing moment, believe me, but one of the things that it does is bring the original conversations, tapes, lectures that Merton had with the novices and scholastics, primarily throughout the 1960s, bring them up to a very acceptable audio quality and provide a brief, and we hope, relatively relevant introduction that sets it within context. Now, when they asked me to do this with the tapes on Rilke and Faulkner and Joyce and then a whole array of other people, including William Blake, I had said yes in a moment of madness, only to discover, of course, that I had to listen to all these things. Right? You can't actually write the introduction until you know what he's saying, right? I had forgotten that part. I'd forgotten the part where you actually have to sit down and listen for hours to the tapes. And it was not too many months before our big conference, International Thomas Merton Society Conference, that we were holding at Connecticut, when I was supposed to go down and do this. And I thought, oh, God, I really don't have time for this. But I set aside the thing rather grudgingly. It was wonderful. It was wonderful, wonderful to hear his voice again. Of course, I'd heard it many times before, but it was wonderful in this context. But it was also wonderful to see the digressions, the addenda, the riffs and spins, the absolute precious irrelevance of so much of what he was saying in the context of what he was going to address. So it would be in a talk on Rainer Maria Rilke, but actually a good deal of it is talking about where Father Abbott is and who's there and who's died and everything else. So he has this long conversation with the monks before he gets into the meat of the matter. And one of the things he keeps coming back to is the personal palpable excitement over the council. You could just feel it in the room when he's with these young monks. Oh, this is this council that we're talking about. You know it's big. This is really important. This is serious stuff. And you could see him bringing such energy to this conversation, right? And he particularly talks about the council in a conference on the French poet Charles Péguy, many of the others as well, but his comments about the council, the politics of the council, the spirit of the council, and indeed the man who called the council. So it made me think more and more that what is there between John the 23rd and Thomas Merton? Is there anything other than the fact that they were contemporaries for a while? Well, there is. And I hope to demonstrate a bit to you tonight some of these points or threads or lines of convergence and connection. What did Roncalli and Thomas Merton have in common? First of all, an impish sense of humor, okay? Even irreverent. Roncalli delighted in punching the bubble of Roman pomposity quite regularly. And there are famous lines. In fact, there's a little volume, The Wit and Wisdom of John the 23rd, somebody went around and collected these things. And at one point, it's one of my favorite lines as a former administrator, somebody asked him, how many people work at the Vatican? And he says, about half. And that makes me think of the current occupant of the See of Peter, who is probably just like him saying the same thing, although perhaps more generous in terms of the numbers. They both had a recognition of the limitations of structures. They knew what could be done, and they knew what could not be done. In fact, the current Pope, Pope Francis, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, quotes John the 23rd regarding the governance of the church, and he said, see everything, turn a blind eye to much, and occasionally correct a little. My sense is that Francis will be doing a lot of that, except he might be correcting a lot. But if he does, and I suspect he will, it's in part because of the changes that were ushered in around the papacy by John 23rd himself. In other words, put bluntly, there would be no place for a Francis unless there had been a John the 23rd. Another thing of common is their deep interiority. Now, I don't know how many of you here have read the journals, Spiritual Journals of Thomas Giuseppe Roncalli, but he kept very detailed journals. And they're conversational, and they're pious in the Italian manner of his time, and but they're also, in their way, homey and deeply insightful. And of course, Merton was a consummate diarist. The prophetic edge to both of them. Certainly John the 23rd never saw himself, never talked about himself as a prophet. He was a bishop. He had been Patriarch of Venice. Next thing you know, he's Bishop of Rome. Okay? And then in January of 1959, not long after his election, he calls several of the papal court together at St. Paul's outside the walls and tells them that he's going to call a council, and shocks everybody, and it shocks him, and he bitches about it, actually, because he says, I tell them this, and they sit there absolutely unmoved. Okay, unmoved. He said, I expected electricity and fire and resistance and excitement, and they just sat there. My sense is that they were traumatized. They were traumatized because they thought, oh, God, where is this taking us, right? And then began the old machinery, as he knew only too well, and which the Curia is much practiced, of simply delaying. This is the gift of inertia. Okay, popes come and go, but the Curia will remain. Okay, no, not to worry, this could be damaging, but he is old, and we'll just get these delaying tactics in place. Well, as we all know, it didn't work that way. An abiding conservatism, in the very best sense of that term, in a profound sense of conservative. I don't mean in the sense of reactionary or ultra-traditionalist. They were anything but. But conservative in the sense that they had a deep sense about the importance of continuity, a deep sense about the rootedness of ideas and structures, that they weren't ephemeral or evanescent or trendy, that there was something here that brings you into a deeper connection, structural and theological, with communion. A commitment to both aggiornamento and ressourcement. Now, aggiornamento, as you know, is an Italian phrase. It basically means just updating or modernizing. And ressourcement, a French term, merely means the reclamation or the going back to the sources themselves. And these two pillars, the recovery of the sources and the updating, became the operating principles of the council itself. Now, many of you will know that the politics around it, the preparatory commission, the Ecclesia document, all these kinds of things, could take up hours, days, months, weeks, and lots of reading. And probably no one as a church historian has done a better job in setting this context than the esteemed Jesuit historian from Harvard, John O'Malley. So if you want to know anything about what went on at the council, there are several historians you can read. He's your best. The next one is a young historian just coming up through the ranks, Massimo Vagioli, who is has a joint appointment at the University of Turin and University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. You can imagine what his accent's like. So both of these historians, one at the apex of his career, one of them just beginning, recognized the supreme importance of what went on in the plotting, the language, the factionalism, and the struggle that always obtains when you have the eruption of spirit in the life of the church. This is never easy. It's always messy. John knew there was going to be a mess, and so did Merton, because Merton understood from the experience of his own order that change often brings with it a great deal of human messiness. That doesn't mean to avoid it. Means to prepare for it. So those are various qualities that they had in common, but one of the most important was their attitude, their disposition, in a way, their habit of mind. And you can see this is a special point of synergy and creative convergence here with John the 23rd. John the 23rd was so pleased that the council was opening in 1962. Remember, he's elected in 1958. He calls the council in 1959. They actually have their first meeting in the fall of 62. Okay, and he's in his 80s already. So he's thinking, oh my God, you know, these guys could win. I could be dead. The first session happens, right? And only a pope can call a council, right? Only a pope can convoke a council. So, I mean, he's kind of racing against the time here. And as you know, he only survives one session. The council goes from 62 to 65. The pope is dead in 63. All right. So it's very important for John the 23rd to be there. And he is there. And his opening address, Gaudet Mater Ecclesia, which means Mother Church Rejoices, is wonderful. Listen to some of these choice passages. This is 1962. The council is just now beginning, and some of the things that Roman Catholics and non-Catholics among us here now see as desirable qualities in the Catholic Church were not even thought about at the time. Here's what happens. At the end of the Mass, John the 23rd delivered his opening address to the council, a moment all had been awaiting. He spoke, of course, in Latin, the official language of the council. He actually issued a decree. he issued seven encyclicals during his short reign of 5 years. People often think he only did one or two, but he did seven, actually. And one of them was to retain Latin as the language of the church. So if you were a bookie, you know, you wouldn't put a big bet on this pope, because, of course, that was the one encyclical that was never implemented. Right. Because of Benedict, we've tended to go back now to Latin as the urtext, and so we have a Latin text from which you had the subsequent translations. But the language of the Vatican has been for a long time Italian. Gaudet Mater Ecclesia, Mother Church Rejoices, were his opening words, and hence the name of the address that he now bears. The Pope, at the beginning, distanced himself, and therefore the council, from a scolding and suspicious approach to the world. You gotta understand, this is very different from previous councils, where councils were called largely to condemn, to declare at the end of various of the propositions, this is specifically true of Vatican I, anathema sit. They were documents that were seen to defend a Catholic position, a doctrine, whatever, that was under siege. And so the response was always defensive and condemnatory. So John the 23rd changes that completely. He doesn't convoke the council and say, we are gathered together to face a world set against the gospel and against the Church of Christ. He doesn't do that at all. He embraces that world. He doesn't scold it. He expressed the hope that the council would enable the church to face the future without fear. And he pointedly rejected the voices of those who in modern times, and I'm quoting, can see nothing but prevarication and ruin, who say that our era in comparison with the past is getting worse. All the doomsayers gathered around, all the apocalyptic types saying everything is coming to naught. While the church is aware of problems, it looks with favor on the marvelous progress of the discoveries of human genius, the Pope argued. The world of today is surely too much taken up with politics and economics, and thus lacks the time to attend to its spiritual welfare. Such a situation, he says, is not right. But we must not forget that the present political order has in many instances created better conditions for the free action of the church. How then is the church to deal with both what is right and what is wrong in society? The Pope repeatedly called for what he calls the medicine of mercy rather than of severity. Listen to that phrase. The medicine of mercy rather than of severity. Who does that sound like? Pope Francis, right? Sounds like Bergoglio, right? I think I'm not one who believes in reincarnation, but if I did, if there was transmigration of souls, metempsychosis, or whatever the technical name is, John the 23rd is back in Bergoglio. He had a little brief moment there with Luciano, Albino Luciani in 1978, but then that got quickly eclipsed. But this Bergoglio is how he views the world. That pastoral openness, that non-judgmental approach. And of course, if you're doing a textual analysis of Francis's addresses, which is very difficult because he departs from the text all the time. I think the press office, La Stampa della Santa Sede, the people who actually write the documents of the Pope are probably collectively suicidal now. Because whenever he goes out, he reads only what he wants, and he departs from the text, and all the digressions are infinitely more interesting. And of course, they don't have the text then, right? Because they can't control what he's saying. Well, John the 23rd was like that. And one of the motifs that surfaces again and again, one of the terms is mercy. Is mercy, not judgment. Well, this language is found in the opening document, the very opening document, Gaudet Mater Ecclesia, saying, here is why I am calling this council. All right, the Council Fathers, we are here. You see that world outside of the Basilica? It's not there for you to condemn. It's not for us to give a list of the ills, sins, heresies, and apostasies of our time. It is rather to look on this world and to see the face of Christ. That's not usually what councils did. Okay? So that there's something profoundly revolutionary, not necessarily in the theology, but in the spirituality and in the politics of the convoking of the council itself. What are we going to do with this council? Got to consider a couple of things, and it's very important. I'll get back to Merton in a minute. It's very important. John the 23rd, people will often call him, you know, the simple peasant. We had the princely Pacelli, right? And we've got Wojtyła with all his doctorates and his learning and his theatrical and gifts and his poetry and everything else. We have Ratzinger, of course, is one of the eminent theologians of the 20th century and all this guy. Oh, yes, and dear old John the 23rd from Bergamo, the peasant. Well, he was a distinguished church historian. He's an authority on the Council of Trent. He was, variously, apostolic visitator to Bulgaria, apostolic delegate to Turkey, apostolic delegate to Greece, patriarch of Venice, and then pope. Not bad for a peasant. Okay. Which means what? Which means that the tendency sometimes from both his critics and from those who loved him, and probably no pope has inspired more love than John the 23rd in the last century, was to misrepresent him as a bit of a simpleton, caught within the complicated web of Vatican machinery and everything else. No. This is the man, more than probably any other single prelate, who saved countless Jewish lives by faking baptism certificates, by working against the occupying authorities, by doing everything he possibly could. Why, up until John Paul II, the most beloved pope in the Jewish community was John the 23rd. So this seeming peasant, you know, had the wisdom of a fox. Okay. He knew what he needed to do to make the Vatican move where he wanted it to move, because he was not actually a Vatican dicasterial prelate. He was a diplomat, fluent in several languages, comfortable working in different, look, Bulgaria, Turkey, Greece, these aren't even Catholic countries. When he gets the plum position in the Vatican diplomatic corps in all of the world, is not, believe it or not, Washington, it's Paris. To be nuncio to Paris, the eldest daughter of the church was the ancient title given to the Church of France. Okay, well, it hasn't been the eldest daughter of the church for a few centuries now, but anyway, or at least a loyal daughter of the church. But what was important was this was the climax, working with de Gaulle. But he had worked with everybody else before he worked with de Gaulle. And the important thing is he understood the world, and he understood its pain. He was a pastor, not just a diplomat. And so when he comes to be pope, he doesn't think like an insider. He doesn't think like somebody who's come up within the system, Secretary of State, Prefect of the Congregation of the Holy Office, as it was then called, or whatever. He comes as a diplomat and as a pastor, and he says, there is something in this world we must love. And somehow or other, our pastoral strategy is wrong. Now, he's not going to say that to the cardinals, but that's what he means. And so everything is shifted. The discourse shifts. There's a wonderful book by O'Malley that examines the rhetoric of the council, John Paul's rhetoric. Not John Paul, but Pope John XXIII's rhetoric. Okay, and it shows, you have an illustration of it here, shows you that it is driven by, again, mercy and love. Where was Merton in all of this? Well, in 1963, there's a lovely volume of poetry called Emblems of a Season of Fury that's published. And in that collection are a series of translations from the Portuguese and from the Spanish and from the French by Merton. Okay? And each one of these poets that he introduces, he provides an introduction to. So he sets the introduction, then he provides several of the poems. So you would have an idea, a poet from Honduras, a poet from Peru, Raisa Maritain's work from France, and of course Ernesto Cardenal from Nicaragua, and this other one from Nicaragua, Ruben Dario. And here's what he says. I love this. This is an exquisite passage. This is Merton speaking. Yet, facing the imminence of even greater and more critical changes than Ruben Dario was able to imagine, this is the Nicaraguan poet he's translated, we can learn from him to advance into the future with trust, not only in the goodness of what is human, but in the infinite goodness of the Creator and Redeemer of what is human. And we can repeat, after Dario, these great words, which were so often echoed in substance by Pope John the 23rd. Here's what he says. Abomedad los hoyos que venzola sodiachis funestos. Abhor the eyes that see only fatal zodiacs. What does he mean? Steer clear of the doomsayers. Right. And then I thought, isn't this wonderful? Here he is. Now, you know, the time that he would be preparing these translations, John the 23rd was still alive. And he's already seen parallels and connections. And he sees in the life-giving poetry of this Nicaraguan poet, with his refusal to be drawn into existentialist despair about the capacity of structures to regenerate themselves or of the world, he finds in that a wonderful resonance with the current occupant of the See of Peter. There is a very interesting collection of letters that Pope John the 23rd received from Thomas Merton. Merton wrote to him. We have them. Bill Shannon, the general editor of the letters of Thomas Merton, brought them together in that early volume, and we have them as a group. There is no letter from John the 23rd to Merton that we have or that we know of. There probably would be a letter of acknowledgement from one of his secretaries, and there is a reference to Loris Capovilla, who was John the 23rd's secretary. And the secretaries, papal secretaries, I don't know how much you know about this, but papal secretaries are extremely important. You don't get access to the Pope without the papal secretary. Cardinals don't get access to the Pope without the papal secretary. I don't know with Francis. He seems to bypass everything. We don't know how many papal secretaries he has. He's got two right now, but he's not really using them. But most popes rely on their secretaries. So John the 23rd had Capovilla. Paul VI had John McGee, who became a bishop in Ireland. Paul II, of course, had the notorious Stanislaw Żywiś, who is the Cardinal Archbishop of Krakow. And Benedict XVI still has Georg Ganschwein, who is the prefect of the papal household and an archbishop. These secretaries are privy to the Pope's mind in a way nobody else has access. So, we don't have any letters from Capovilla, but we presume that we have an acknowledgement of a receipt of the letters that he received, that John the 23rd would have received. And we do, actually, because we have John the 23rd giving his stole to Thomas Merton. Thomas Merton is absolutely ecstatic about receiving this stole. I'll quote from it in a minute. It's almost rock star-like in its enthusiasm. But Capovilla does seem to be somewhere in the background, and it's very interesting, and prescient, I think. Bill Shannon, in his editorial note, says the following. John the 23rd's obvious love for people made him perhaps the most loved pope of modern times. He realized that reforms were needed in the church and saw the need of demythologizing the papacy and diminishing the cult of the pontifical personality. Extraordinary. Because in fact, that would not happen. The power and the mystique of the papacy would grow from 1978 to this year, exponentially. In fact, it would go the absolute reverse. And what you have with Francis is the continuation, if Bill is right, and I think he is, of the effort of John 23rd to demystify the papacy, to remove its monarchical structures, and to reclaim its primal ministry as the fishermen's. This is the fishermen's. And I think that's absolutely extraordinary. And I think there is evidence of it from the moment that Francis was elected, that Francis is continuing this work of John the 23rd. John the 23rd began all kinds of things, the slow demythologizing, but he was only around for 5 years. There's only so much you could do, and calling the council was an extraordinary, gargantuan effort in its own right. But I think you can already see that Francis has picked this up with energy and verve and with passion, and it happened at the very moment when the Pope, the new Pope, came out on the loggia at the Apostolic Palace without Camaro, without Ehrman, and without the Mozzetta. That's not done. Not done. And when the Pope gives his first Ubi et Orbi, instead of giving it, he asks for the people to pray for him. That has never been done before. So in those few minutes on that balcony, Pope Francis has changed the papacy. against the papacy. His famous line, these are lovely things because you think they're apocryphal, then you find out they're true because we have people recording them all the time. Cardinals coming back, giving evidence of them, recording. But when he turned to Monsignor Marini, who is the major domo for all the liturgical events, he turned to him and he said, Monsignore, the carnival is over. The carnival is over. And that will now go down like Gregory the Seventh's great line, you know, I have suffered iniquity for the church, or suffered great iniquity for the church. That it's one of those lines that you realize that will be etched in historical memory because it's a turning point. So it's kind of a Rubicon, all right? All right, I see my role as Bishop of Rome as no more than when I was Bishop of Buenos Aires, driving on the train with everybody else, living simply with other priests and not on a palace, and being available to the people. He just simply transferred that episcopal model from Buenos Aires and took it to the Tiber. No one had ever done that before, not in recent memory. That's extraordinary. But it's consistent in a very real way with Roncalli's perception of the papal ministry and the papal, and the exercise of the papal ministry, and Thomas Merton's understanding that the Pope himself is a pivotal figure not only of unity, but of inspiration for the church. And then you begin to see in the letters, and I'll come to these now, how they bring together Merton's understanding, very deep understanding of what John's doing. And he's doing this before John does it. The letters actually predate the council. John is elected. Okay? He's elected Pope in 1958. A couple of months later, he gets a letter from Merton. November the 10th, 1958. Notice the persistent, bold, and almost temerarious tone of the letter, but deeply respectful in the manner of the ecclesiastical protocol of the day. He says to the Pope, it seems to me that as a contemplative, I do not need to lock myself into solitude and lose all contact with the rest of the world. Rather, this pearl world has a right to a place in my solitude. It is not enough for me to think of the apostolic value of prayer and penance. I also have to think in terms of contemplative grasp of the political, intellectual, artistic, and social movements in this world, by which I mean a sympathy for the honest aspirations of so many intellectuals everywhere in the world and the terrible problems that they have to face. I have had at the experience of seeing that this kind of understanding and friendly sympathy on the part of a monk who really understands them has produced striking effects among artists, writers, publishers, poets, etc., who have become my friends without my ever having to leave this cloister. I have even been in correspondence with the Russian writer who won the Nobel Prize in Literature, Boris Pasternak. This was before the tragic change in the situation. We got to understand one another very well. In short, with the approval of my superiors, I have exercised an apostolate, small and limited though it be, within a circle of intellectuals from other parts of the world, and it has been quite simply an apostolate of friendship. Having presented this to you, an idea which also interests some of my priest novices who have come from other religious congregations, I want to ask on my behalf and theirs if your holiness believes that there is a place for a limited apostolate of this kind. Publications, exchanges of letters, limited of course, gatherings of intellectuals and a monastery for conferences. And if your holiness believes that special houses of this kind should exist with a staff that is more or less trained for this kind of apostolate. And then he goes on. Now, he's Merton, and he raises the issue about Latin America. And you can see him thinking, I'm going to write to the Pope because I like this guy. The vibes are good. You can hear him saying it. The vibe is good. I got an abbot I can't get around. Okay? Maybe this guy will listen to me. Okay? So part of this is tactical. All right? Maybe I can't always get on the same page with James Fox, but maybe with Giuseppe Roncalli, we can be on the same page. Right? So there's a boldness in the letter, but it's also the realization, because Roncalli allows him to think that this is a worthy thing to think about and to raise and to propose and in his own limited way to do. Do you think he would have written such a letter to Pius XII? Oh, not possible. It's because he senses the openness. There's an aperture here. Ooh, God, I like the sound of this one. And so he moves in very quickly, intuitively. It's non-judgmental. He's calling for rich engagement with the world and with the world of ideas. He senses that this pope, again, this is what is so remarkable. The pope has not even at this point announced the summoning of the council itself. This has not happened. It's 58, not 59. Right? So Merton's leap, his ability to read in what he's already heard, the sounds, the gestures, the movement, the countenance. He sees in John the 23rd something he hasn't seen in the papacy for a very long time. When he becomes a Roman Catholic, the Pope is Ashirati, Pius XI. During most of his monastic life, certainly as a priest, it's E. Eugenio Pacelli. Okay? Now, there's a Pope that's unlike everybody else, right? And his response is not cautious or measured or diffident. It's like a child. God, there's such enthusiasm, something happening here. And he writes right away, and says, you know, what about these ideas of intellectual circles? Now, these ideas of intellectual circles would have been, my sense, would have been generated from conversations he has with his close friend Jacques Maritain, because in the 1920s, Maritain and many of the others, Piggy, to some degree Claudel, Mauriac, Abet, Bernano, many of them, so they all break and go in their different directions, of course. Some of the great Thomists like Jusson, but they're all part of these intellectual circles of Moudon. Okay, so the Maritains are at the center of them, setting up these circles in France where intellectuals and artists and thinkers and composers and everybody can come together and to talk. And so what do you have? You have a wonderful fluorescence. You have a renaissance of Catholic thought and vitality and spirituality in France. We haven't seen anything like it since in France. He wants that to happen here. This happened in the States, sees the election of Roncalli as his way of saying, hey, you know, Gethsemane, we could be the center of these kinds of points of entry and engagement with the arts and with intellectuals, making the church and its mission real and palpable. He talks about this in a letter, subsequent letter, dated February the 11th, 1960, when he speaks particularly about the Protestants. Because he already senses with John the 23rd and his understanding of the separated churches or the separated brethren that the relationship of the church to Protestantism is moving away from its hostile, triumphalist, and fearful stance to working towards some kind of rapprochement, which has been going on in minor circles, the Mercier people, the Halifax people, the Malines conversations at the turn of the century. People have been doing this at various levels, but really not at any high institutional level. But John the 23rd is, he's raising ecumenism, unity, love for our Protestant brothers and sisters and their churches to a new level of public awareness. And instantly, Merton moves in on it. And he uses examples of openness to the world in the letter of 1960 to the Protestants as a particular sign that this is a great moment of grace. In a letter also in April the 11th of 1960, he expresses his gratitude over a gift. The Pope sends him his stole, which I think is here, is it not, Paul? It's on exhibit in the center, the stole that he has sent. The stole, of course, is it's a priestly stole, goes over the shoulders. Okay. He says to the Pope, he writes back to the Pope, how can I express to you my gratitude and the emotion with which I have received the honor bestowed on me by Your Holiness in sending me this beautiful stole, worn, and blessed by Your Holiness? It is truly the greatest honor of my life. Now this is Merton. Okay. This is the same Merton. Oh, I just read the book yesterday, and this is the finest poet I've ever read in my life. Then the next day, oh, just discovered this great novelist. He's the greatest thing that's ever happened. Oh, just met this person. So there is that kind of effusive, unchecked enthusiasm. But it is also true that the giving of this gift and its receiving was a signal moment in his life. This magnificent gift brings all of us many graces. And he goes on to thank the Pope in quite florid but traditional language. In November the 11th of 1961, and this is the last correspondence we have, and it's rather truncated, we don't have the complete correspondence, it is clear Bill Shannon believes, there's no evidence of this quite that I know of, although there may be a doctoral work that's done on this, established it firmly now, that some of the insights that would appear in John the 23rd's famous March 1963 peace encyclical Pacem in Terris takes part of its genesis from his reading Merton. Yeah. Now, I don't know, there may be someone who's established a direct causal link here. I think this is speculation on Shannon's part. I like to think that it's true, and it's very possible that some of the things that he says in this truncated letter, we don't have the complete letter, of November the 11th, 1961, in which he's talking about disarmament, nuclear war, and other things that are threatening civilization, that John the 23rd already involved behind the scenes, as we know, and will be very much involved in helping to set up channels of communication that will contribute to the resolution of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Right? So all these things going on, very political, very behind the scenes, will result in the publication of his great peace encyclical. And it's not unreasonable to think that in some way, perhaps, his reading of Merton would have contributed significantly to that encyclical. Clearly, Merton sees in the encyclical itself a complete validation, a complete endorsement of his own thinking, and would make the argument, sometimes not too subtly, that they allow, speaking of his own censors in his own order, they allow a pope to say this, but they won't allow me to say it. Right? So he will often invoke John the 23rd. Oh, well, John the 23rd said it, right? Look, he said it. How come I have to stop writing? How come my writings are censured for at least a couple of years? I think it's lifted in 1965. But how come they're censured for my case, but they're not in the case of a pope? And the pope's not saying anything more radical than I do, which is true, in fact. He says on October the 16th, 1962, now talking about the council, he's now moved into the council. This is his entry in one of his diaries, actually. He's not writing a letter at this point. And he says, John the 23rd was first pope. When he was named first pope, he would sleep short sleep and wake up saying, I must consult the pope about this. And then, as his mind cleared, he would say, wait a minute, I'm the Pope. Well, now he is Pope, and he has his council. It's October the 16th, 1962. The council opens on October the 11th, so it's 5 days into the council. It has been a great opening, and you can see this enthusiasm, not only in the diary entries, but in the talks that he's giving to the young monks. He received the diplomats in the Sistine Chapel. He pointed to the Michelangelo Jesus of the Last Judgment and said, gentlemen, what will it be? He said what needed to be said, what has been said before, but never so forcefully or directly. He is a great pope. He said the people of the world want peace, that God will judge severely the rulers who fail in their responsibility to the people. Later, in the same year, just a couple of months later, he would write a letter to Sergius Bosakov. And Bosakov was a Russian Orthodox scholar, teacher, priest, and eminent ecumenist in his own right. And he urges him. He says, you know, when you're talking to the Pope, you know, tell him stuff, you know. Let him know. Let him know. Draw on his personal qualities. Help us to do the providential work of the council. Because, and he repeats it again, we have a very great pope. And then he says something that you can find in several of the letters, by the way, in various snippets, and you can also find it in various of the diary letters entries. I personally love this Pope. There's a depth of affection here that you don't ever really detect in Merton's writing, in my experience, with any other prelate. Okay. There is a comment that would indicate that he doesn't always feel this way about popes, because there's a letter to E.I. Watkin that stated Holy Thursday, 1963, which would have been not too long before John XXIII's death in June of 1963. Watkin was a British philosopher, thinker, polyglot, and there's a long extant correspondence between them. And he says this, this is Merton, "I do think Pope John has been entirely providential. He is a great and fine Pope, and so much better than the last one." So he doesn't leave a lot of leeway here on what he thinks about Pius. There are some touching diary entries that chronicle the dying of the Pope. Now, he's not being lugubrious, okay? And you can read in these, I'm going to read a little bit of it, these diary entries, again, this level of affection and sympathy and warmth for a man who is dying, and who in many ways is his father. "It is hot. Pope John is dying. Perhaps he is dead. Already yesterday at this time, he was in a coma in an oxygen tent with the papal guards around his apartments. Last night he was conscious for a moment, they say, and he smiled and he blessed those around him. I've been thinking of him all day and praying for him, especially at the High Mass after noon. The world owes this man a great debt in his simplicity, and it is hard to feel that we can do without someone like him. He has done so much in 4 years, four and a half, to remind people that Christian charity is not pure fiction. Yet, in spite of it all, will people ever again have confidence in love? Will they not think that everyone who has spoken of love has finally betrayed them? This is what they want to believe, and it is the most threatening thing about the current climate." And of course, he's setting the death of the Pope against the ever-worsening situation in terms of nuclear disarmament and whatnot. Now, they've managed to avoid the Cuban missile conflagration, potential conflagration, but the situation has only mildly improved. And so the death of the Pope is set against this backdrop of menace and apocalypse. Just a couple of days later, he writes, and this is his last entry on him as he's alive. "Pope John Paul died yesterday, a holy and good man. And he was both because he was, first of all, a man. That is to say, human. This is the great meaning of his papacy, of the council, of Pacem in Terris. Not humanism, but the bare statement of the fundamental value of humanity. Pacem in Terris, his encyclical on peace, peace on earth, is not theological. It is simply says war is inhuman, and therefore a sin. Not that war is a sin, and therefore you must not use the bombs. Certainly everyone loved him, and statements to this effect, though spoiled by the fact that language is too exhausted to convey it, are probably sincere. May he rest in peace, this great and good father, whom I certainly loved, and who had been good to me, sending me the stole and many blessings. And I don't think he has stopped being a father to us and to me even now. He will one day be canonized." And he will, in a few months. I think if we last that long, little aside to the nuclear menace, and I do not hesitate to ask his intercession now. Enter Santo Subito. When Paul II died, you will remember the tremendous eruption, Saint Now, that came from the piazza, right? And you will remember as well Oscar Romero, and the fact that Romero is invoked as a saint even by bishops in Central and South America. He's Saint Oscar, whether Rome ever gets around to it or not. Okay? And this is what he's saying. He may be canonized, right? But I pray for his intercession even now. This good and holy man, and I loved him. It's quite a marvelous correspondence, by the way, because what it does is underscore not just simply the fact that Merton found in Roncalli somebody who shared his concerns about the future of the planet, about the importance of an inclusive humanity, but he did so with a pastoral openness, a transparency, a natural goodness that helped him to transcend the structures and politics that are so often our major encumbrance. Well, we know that Merton himself would continue to write. Had already written a number of letters. In 1962, he was forbidden to write about war, and so these letters were gathered together, and they would be known as the Cold War letters, basically 1961 to 1962. There's about 110 of these letters, and they would subsequently, of course, be published in various places. We also know that Merton was increasingly frustrated with people who suppressed his writings. In fact, in a particularly angry moment, he writes, "I had been hoping," this is in 1964, "to republish the few articles on nuclear war which had been permitted by Don Gabriel, the Sorte, who is the general of the order, thinking that it was enough that he had permitted them once. Not so. The new general, Dom Ignace, dug into the files, held a meeting of definitors, and declared that there was to be no republication of these articles. Thus, I am still not permitted to say what Pope John said in Parchman Terrace. And the reason that it is not the job of a monk, it is for the bishops. Well, certainly it is a basis of monastic tradition, and he talks about the job of the monk is to weep, not to teach. Monachi plangentis non ducentis est officium," he says. "But with things here, what with our cheese business and all the other plangent functions we have undertaken, it seems strange that a monk should be forbidden to stand up for the truth, particularly when the truth in this case is disastrously neglected. There is no consolation, only futility in the idea that one is a kind of a martyr for a cause." And then he goes on and he talks about his frustrations, and then he ends his diary entry with the wonderful line. He's now whipped himself up. He ends it with, "I have a splitting headache." And the diary ends. Parchman Terrace, the Pope's encyclical of 1963, his last of the seven encyclicals and his most famous in many ways, certainly was born in a time of apocalypse, imminent. John 23rd never despairs, though. Never despairs. And Merton comes back again and again to Parchman Terrace. There would be two conferences on Parchman Terrace actually held, conferences that were run actually by his friend W.H. Perry, Ping Perry, on the initiatives spawned by the encyclical. And the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, which is actually in Santa Barbara, California, which Merton would meet in the last year of his life, where he would go briefly for the last year of his life, were held. Two of the conferences were held. One was in New York in 1965, and the other was held in Geneva in 1967, just a year before his death. But Merton's enthusiasm for Parchman Terrace, for its implementation, for the realization that peace has to be now because the alternative is ruin, is drawn in great measure not just from his scholarly investigation into teaching about peace that goes back to the Church Fathers, his work on the Contra Celsum, his understanding of origin, his various writings that appear in Seeds of Destruction. Yes, they're all there. Okay, but it's also carried by the profound conviction that in Parchman Terrace, John the 23rd has raised it to a level of acceptance and approval which hitherto it did not enjoy. And so with John the 23rd no longer on the scene, but Parchman Terrace still there, Merton would go back again and again to try to say, we need to take some of the stuff that comes from this and to implement it. Well, let me just briefly, very briefly, give you a couple of quotes from Parchment Terrace itself that would indicate what it is in the encyclical that Merton found attractive. It's a wonderfully accessible encyclical, shorn of much of the juridical parlance was typical of pontifical writing, addressed to the world, not just to Catholics. He affirmed the importance that every human being has the right to worship God. He talks about the marvelous order that prevails with the scientific research. Notice, again, not condemnation. He talks about the characteristics of the modern period involving a progressive involvement in social and economic conditions for working people, the rise of women in political and social life, and he sees this as a good, the decline of imperialism. Okay? Now, some of this may be naive, some of it may be premature, but all of it is a rejection of the traditional papal list of outrages that they find in modernism, scientism, laicism, and any other ism that is seen as opposed to a specific ecclesiology. John the 23rd does not see the world that way. And here's the lovely passage which I'll conclude. At the end, when he's releasing the document, it's his last encyclical. He will be dead within a couple of months. He says the following to the diplomatic corps as he releases the document. I want you to know that this is an issue, an appeal to love for the people of this time. That's what this encyclical is. It's not a condemnation. It's not a scolding. It's not a repudiation. It's an appeal to love. Let us recognize, Your Excellencies, the common origin that makes us brothers and sisters and come together. Merton was profoundly moved by the concluding remark of the Pope, and he has his own concluding remark, I think, that nicely brings it to an end on August the 17th, 1964, when he enters the following in his diary. When one has lived through the pontificate of John the 23rd, one cannot go back to the old positions again. One has to see things forever now in a new light. I know that there are forces awake in the church that will refuse to go back to sleep. Thank you.